From WNYC New York Public Radio, I'm Leonard Lopate. This is just one segment of the Leonard Lopate Show, but every interview is available on demand at WNYC.org. This on-demand service is made possible by WNYC and its listeners, so please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org.
WNYC On Demand is supported by Open, how American Express serves small business. Open offers a range of products and services designed exclusively for small business. Details at 1-800-NOW-OPEN or open.com.
You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Scott Ritter has thought a lot about Iraq over the years. First, as an intelligence officer during the Gulf War, later as a UN weapons inspector for 7 years, and frustrated with what he perceived were ineffective measures taken by the UN to disarm Saddam Hussein, he resigned that job in 1998, calling the inspection program a sham. But in 2002, Mr. Ritter surprised almost everyone when he became one of the most prominent critics of the Bush administration's claims that Iraq had weapons of mass destruction. It made him a subject of controversy at the time, but as we've come to know, most of Mr. Ritter's claims were accurate. Now Scott Ritter has turned his attention to another weapons debate, and the result is his latest book, Target Iran, The Truth About the White House's Plans for Regime Change. It's published by Nation Books, and I'm very pleased to welcome him back to my show today. Hello.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Here's a conservative publishing with Nation Books.
Well, it's an American publishing with an American publishing house. It just so happens that Nation Books, in today's, you know, polarized America, Nation Books has taken the courageous stance to speak out against what they perceive to be inequities of the current administration.
Do you think that your track record on Iraq will lead more people to believe your views on Iran?
I would hope so, because in both instances, I'm fact-based, not faith-based. I don't sit here and try to impose an ideology on people. I simply say, here are the facts, and we need to make our assessments based on this fact. It dates back to my training as an intelligence officer, where my job wasn't to tell my boss what he or she wanted to hear, just say what the facts were.
Well, before we get to Iran, just a few moments on Iraq. What happened between 1998 and 2002 that convinced you that Iraq no longer had weapons of mass destruction?
Well, see, that's one of those little perceptions that I said that they don't have weapons. I never said that. What I said is that the Bush administration hasn't made the case that they have them. I was quite clear in 1998 when I resigned that we had not completed the task of disarmament. The task as set forth by the Security Council was 100% disarmament. I was also quite clear, citing United Nations inspection results, that we had accounted for 95% to 98% of the weaponry. I was also quite clear that we didn't know what happened to a certain element of it, but we had no evidence that it was still retained. We could mitigate against that uncertainty by noting that we monitored the totality of their industrial infrastructure and had no evidence of either retained capability or reconstituted. But the process is what was important, the process of inspections, verification, disarmament, and we weren't being allowed to do that job. So I resigned, saying we can't say we completed this task. In December 1998, Bill Clinton bombed Iraq, citing Iraq's refusal to cooperate with the inspectors. He also said that these weapons exist, et cetera. At that point in time, it became clear to me that the system was broke. Bill Clinton used the inspection process to gather intelligence about Saddam Hussein's regime, not about weapons. And from that moment on, I said, we need to fix the system. And in 2000, I wrote an article called The Case for the Qualitative Disarmament of Iraq, where June 2000, I wrote it. If you read it, it's 100% accurate. It says, look, there's uncertainties here, but if you take it down, nuts and bolts, they don't have a viable program, and that's the analysis I stuck by, and that's the analysis I held the Bush administration accountable to.
And you were ridiculed? Hans Blix was ridiculed? Because if you say something that everyone doesn't want to hear, and I'm not just saying the politicians ridiculed you, much of the media ridiculed you at the time.
Well, yeah, that's okay. Like I said, One of the truly entertaining things today is to sit back and read the transcripts from that time, and I can pat myself on the back and said, you were dead right then, and they were dead wrong. And you know what? Those transcripts aren't going away.
So what about Iran? Do you believe that it's pursuing a nuclear weapons program?
Again, it's not what I believe that counts. It's what the facts show. And the facts put forward by the International Atomic Energy Agency state and demonstrate that there is no evidence to sustain the allegations that Iran has a nuclear weapons program. They have not been totally forthcoming. They do have a nuclear enrichment program. There is concern that an enrichment program could be used, that technology could be used to facilitate the production of weapons. All that's legitimate. But the Bush administration has stated unequivocally that Iran has a nuclear weapons program. And the IAEA has responded by saying there is no evidence to back that. So I'm going with the facts.
Now, you enrich uranium if you want to use it to generate power as well as weapons. But there's a big difference between the enrichment. Do we have any idea how much they're enriching it and how much they'd need to enrich it if they were going to try to build a bomb?
Well, yeah. I mean, we know exactly what's required. For nuclear energy, you need 3.5 to 5% enriched uranium.
Is that what they're generally doing?
Well, that's all they've done. And that's all they demonstrated doing.
That's what they claim they're doing.
And they can't. Well, it's not even what they claim they do. That's what the IAEA has verified that they're doing. And it's not. They don't even do this well. I mean, this is the other point that comes out from the inspections is the Iranians haven't even perfected this technology. They have the feedstock, the uranium hexafluoride, has impurities. And when you put them in these centrifuges that are spinning at 70,000 RPMs, even a microgram suddenly takes on the characteristics of several kilograms, and it rips the centrifuge apart. They can't do it. They haven't perfected it. And yet we're sitting here saying that they're not only enriching, but they're feeding it back in over and over and over again to get the 80 to 90% needed for a weapon. No, there's no evidence of this.
But 70% of all Americans believe that they're developing weapons.
Because 70% of I'd say 100% of Americans are pre-programmed to believe almost anything negative that comes out about Iran. We've demonized Iran since 1979. And therefore, you know, the easiest thing in the world to do is say something negative about Iran, just like it was about Iraq. Hey, Saddam is capable of doing X. Of course he is, because he's the brutal dictator of Baghdad. The Iranians are capable of doing Y. Of course they are, because they're terrible theocrats of Tehran. I mean, no one cares about the facts. We're pre-programmed.
Well, but also Iran seems to be its own worst enemy in this regard. Ahmadinejad makes these outrageous statements, and it's hard to trust this guy.
Well, first of all, we shouldn't be talking about trusting Ahmadinejad. The first thing we need to do is understand what we're dealing with. And when we talk about Iran, we need to recognize that the president of Iran is a figurehead. He has some domestic leverage. He can sign laws. He can sign treaties. But when it comes to national security, he has no power. The power resides completely with the supreme leader, the Ayatollah Khamenei, the Guardian Council, the Expediency Council. This is where the power lies, and so we should reflect on what they say. And the Supreme Leader issued a fatwa, a religious edict, that rejected nuclear weapons. In 2003, the Supreme Leader reached out to the United States government and said, we'd like to normalize relations, we want to negotiate a peace treaty with Israel. That's completely different from the ludicrous statements made by Ahmadinejad, and we're willing to put the nuclear program on the table. We rejected that. We rejected that. It's not the Iranians.
And why do you think we did? Because we were already building up to war with Iran?
Absolutely. The policy for Iran is regime change. That means we need to terminate the existence of the theocracy.
My guest is Scott Ritter. His latest book, Target Iran, The Truth About the White House's Plans for Regime Change. It's published by Nation Books. Well, I'm not sure I understand why we would have that kind of policy, considering the kind of problems we're facing now in Iraq. Wouldn't Iraq have made people in the White House a little more reluctant to think about regime change once again?
Well, again,
and Iran is a much more difficult country, bigger population, a country perhaps a bit more sophisticated, and defeated Iraq in a war that Iraq initiated.
You have to remember, there's a lot of momentum behind this regime change policy. It's not something that George Bush simply pulled out of a hat. Since 1979, the policy of the United States government has been to remove the theocrats from power. That's why we had the confused policy of Ronald Reagan. Who do we support? The brutal dictator in Baghdad or the theocrats in Tehran? And the irony of the Iran-Iraq war is we supported both. We gave weapons to the Iranians, and we gave intelligence and financial support to the Iraqis. The Clinton administration took on the stance of dual containment, containing both Baghdad and Tehran. But again, the underpinnings of dual containment is regime change. Contain them until which time we can facilitate their removal. And so you have this momentum heading towards regime change that a temporary hiccup in Iraq from the standpoint of the neoconservatives, because remember, they have yet to acknowledge that they have failed. They have yet to acknowledge that they did something wrong in Iraq. They still believe this is a grand crusade. And in June 2006, they published a national security strategy document that not only gave a stamp of approval for preemptive wars of aggression like we waged in Iraq, but named Iran 16 times as the number one threat to the national security of the United States. So we haven't learned a thing from Iraq, especially from the standpoint of those who are formulating and implementing policy.
So how did regime change become the focal point of the Bush administration's Middle East and foreign policy? It's something that Republicans used to make fun of.
Well, and you know, this dates back to the end of the Cold War when, you know, during the Reagan administration, there was a clique of hardcore neoconservatives that bought into this notion of global struggle. It was us against them, good versus evil. And when the evil empire, because that's what we used to call the Soviet Union, when it collapsed, there's suddenly this vacuum. And what the neoconservative ideologues who resided in the Reagan administration said is, we can't allow anything to step into this vacuum. So they, in 1992, Paul Wolfowitz, Scooter Libby, working for Dick Cheney, was then Secretary of Defense, wrote a draft paper, a vision statement on where the military needed to go. It was rejected by Congress. Bush got out. During the Clinton administration, they came up, they reformulated it. In 1997, it became a vision statement for the Project for New American Century, which in turn became the 2002 National Security Strategy. That's where regime change comes from.
You say that the CIA is working with the Mujahideen al-Khalq in the hope of destabilizing the regime in Iran. How do we know that?
Well, we know it from a number of reasons. I know it because I've spoken with the CIA paramilitary operative.
But can we trust the CIA anymore? Didn't they
bungle
the lead up to the war in Iraq?
Right. Two different questions. How do we know that they're working with the Mujahideen al-Khalq? Because I have spoken with the people who are doing it. Seymour Hersh has spoken with sources, et cetera. Second question, can we trust them? It's not a matter of trusting the CIA. They have some outstanding people. I've worked very closely with CIA paramilitaries in doing different things around the world. These are high-quality individuals, dedicated professionals. If they get a good mission statement, they'll execute it. It's not them we need to worry about. It's not the small guys. It's the president. It's the Congress. It's the people who formulate policy, implement policy, and conduct oversight of policy. That's where the failure resides.
So the stated aim would be to destroy Iran's nuclear facilities, but the real aim, you're saying, would be to destabilize the current regime?
Well, one only has to take a look at some of the reporting that's come out about the targeting, the potential targeting of Iran. You know, if you're talking about just nuclear facilities, you've got a dozen targets. Okay, right now they have over 1,000 impact points plotted. That tells you that A, they don't know what they're bombing, or B, they're going to bomb a lot more than just the nuclear power. And they've said, administration people have said that when they bomb, it's not just going to be the nuclear. They're going to seek to nullify the military and destabilize the leadership. That's a different target set altogether.
In fact, Seymour Hersh wrote in The New Yorker that plans have been drawn up to bomb Iran until regime change occurs. I wonder how that even happens and how the rest of the world would respond to that sort of approach.
Well, we saw what happened with sort of a minor version of this when Israel bombed Lebanon in an effort to get the Lebanese government, the Lebanese people, to reject Hezbollah during the most recent clash. It backfired on Israel. We now see Hezbollah elevated to a status that it hasn't held in a long time. They're strengthened. The people Israel was trying to build up have been weakened. It doesn't work. You can't bomb a people into submission.
And yet it seems to still be the policy. Not only Seymour Hersh, Time Magazine, your book. We'll take a little break. When we come back, we'll find out just how all of this is working and what the possibilities of success might actually be. When we discuss this with Scott Ritter, whose book Target Iran, The Truth About the White House's Plans for Regime Change, published by Nation Books, continues. Stay with us. Scott Ritter is with us. His latest book is called Target Iran, The Truth About the White House's Plans for Regime Changes, published by Nation Books. And a number of listeners have called and asked how we can negotiate with a country that took our embassy, that's now headed by a Holocaust denier. Can we, we saw what happened when we negotiated with Korea. They just decided to go ahead and do whatever they wanted anyway.
Well, I mean, comparing Korea and Iran is like comparing apples and oranges. These are two totally separate issues. Look, the alternative to not negotiating is war. And I would hope that no matter, you know, Ahmadinejad's words, how many people have they killed? They took the embassy over in 79. That's water under the bridge. And what a lot of Americans don't understand is the people who took the embassy over were the Mujahideen al-Khalq, the same organization the CIA is working with today. So, you know, the first thing here before we start getting all in an uproar is to educate ourselves about the reality of what we're dealing with.
Does Iran have a valid argument when it says that Article 4 under the Non-Proliferation Treaty gives them every right under international law to enrich uranium?
100%. Iran has doing nothing that is violating international law. In fact, Iran has, with one exception, and the exception is thanks to U.S.-imposed sanctions in 1979, which denied Iran the ability to get technology from Germany, from China, from Russia to build peaceful nuclear energy. Iran went to the black market and acquired technology from Pakistan, and then they spun a centrifuge without declaring. They produce a microscopic amount of barely enriched material. That is a violation of the Non-Proliferation Treaty. They were caught. They admitted it. They opened up their facilities to inspection, and the rest is history. But when it comes to their basic right under Article 4 of the Non-Proliferation Treaty, Iran is permitted to do what they are doing. They are doing nothing illegal. In fact, you can make the argument that it's the United States that's operating outside the framework of law and insisting that a new standard apply only for Iran.
Different from what the European Union is insisting on?
Well, see, the European Union started out with their initial negotiation position that said, when they signed the Tehran document, that Iran is permitted to enrich. They just asked for a temporary suspension while a new inspection protocol was brought in place. Well, the new inspection protocol was brought in place, and Iran went, how long is this temporary suspension supposed to go on? And suddenly, the United States and the Europeans went, forever. And the Iranians went, nah, I don't think so. We're going to enrich, and we're going to continue to enrich.
Does any of this mean anything if Russia and China don't agree with the West on this?
Well, what it means is that the likelihood of armed conflict is increased. Because if Russia and China aren't going to agree to American demands for economic sanctions, as long as America continues to characterize the Iranian threat as being in the form of a nuclear weapons program, you now have limited the methods of dealing with it to the military option.
You've said that what we have with Iran is a diplomatic crisis. And James Baker is going to Iran, isn't he?
I certainly hope James Baker goes to Iran, and I certainly hope he meets with the right people in
Iran.
You
went recently.
I just came back in September. Look, I won't consider the diplomatic option being engaged until Condoleezza Rice goes to Tehran and meets with the Supreme Leader. That's diplomacy, sending a proxy to do your work. That's not. We need an official of the U.S. government to go who's mandated by law to represent the United States. And that's Condoleezza Rice, not James Baker.
Well, we've refused to negotiate with the North Koreans, and we've refused to negotiate with Iran because we say we're standing on principle.
Wow. Well, we also refused to negotiate with Iraq. Now we can stand on 2,770 graves. So you know what? Principle? My principle is in support of the Constitution, the rule of law, and the men and women who give their lives in defense of that, not in some sort of ideologically driven notion that we're America, we're tougher than you, we don't have to sink to your level.
You write, any American ground invasion of Iran would be doomed to fail. Faced with such a disaster, the United States would have no choice but to escalate the conflict along military lines, which means to engage Iran with nuclear weapons. Now, that would mean that we'd be dropping the first nuclear weapons since Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Wouldn't that open up at Pandora's box, the next thing you know, countries in conflict like India and Pakistan might say, well, the U.S. did it with Iran, and we have similar problems here.
Well, I'm not so much worried about India and Pakistan nuking each other. I think they have this thing called mutually assured destruction taking place here, so there's this deterrence. What I'm worried about is, as you said, letting the nuclear genie out of the bottle. And especially in this day and age where we have uncontrolled proliferation coming out of North Korea, the potential of uncontrolled proliferation coming out of Pakistan, if we nuke Iran, I think we're initiating a process that will not end until an Islamic bomb is exploded on American soil. And so I've asked everybody who sits there and says, we need to take on the Iranians. I said, so just pick an American city. Pick one, because we're going to lose one. We might lose two, but just pick one. You want to lose San Francisco, Boston, Seattle, New York? Just pick one, because we're going to lose one. And now ask yourself, is this really worth it?
That's going to be because somebody, an Al-Qaeda type, would come with a dirty bomb?
Not a dirty bomb. A dirty bomb's nothing. A dirty bomb's a joke. A dirty bomb's an exaggerated.
That's one of the suitcase bombs.
I need even a suitcase. They put it in a container, bring it in a ship, and they take out the whole damn city. This isn't going to be a small event. And would it be Al Qaeda? I don't know what it would be. But you know, if we attack Iran against international law, and if we use nuclear weapons, Al Qaeda is going to be the little kids on the block. We're going to create a whole new level of anti-American fundamentalism hatred out in the world today, like I said, that will not rest until revenge is exacted.
So who did you talk to when you went to Iran in August?
Well, you know, I went in September. I was supposed to talk to Ahmadinejad and some other people. I had cleared it with the Iranian mission here. I got there, and the funny thing is no one knew I was coming. I sort of got off the airplane, and they went, who are you and why are you here? So in a way, it was disappointing. In a way, it was liberating, because now I got to wander Tehran, and I ended up meeting up with some Revolutionary Guard commanders, people who initiated the contact with Hezbollah back in 1979, people who digged the tunnels, people who took on the Mujahideen al-Khalq. Got fascinating insights in the Revolutionary Guard Command. I met with some politicians. I met with the people of Tehran. I went down to Ahmadinejad's home turf in South Tehran and walked the streets, went in the shops and said, hey, tell me why you support this guy. What's going on? And what I found out is that the political picture in Iran is extremely complicated. It's very gray. It's not black and white. And again, coming back to Ahmadinejad, you know, he doesn't have 100% support at home. There's a lot of people who voted for him who aren't happy with what he's saying. There's a lot of people who voted against him who still have an anti-Ahmadinejad posturing. So the key point here to Americans is stop viewing Iran as good versus evil, black and white. There's a lot of gray there. And I would say the gray leans towards white because it is a very modern, Western, pro-American society we're dealing with here.
My guest is Scott Ritter, who worked as an officer in the U.S. Marines and as a ballistics missile advisor to General Norman Schwarzkopf during the Gulf War, and then later became one of the U.N.'s top weapons inspectors in Iraq between 1991 and 1998, and then a critic of U.S. policy toward Iraq in the buildup to the war. Now he's written a book about the buildup to the next possible war called Target Iran, The Truth About the White House's Plans for Regime Change, published by Nation Books. This is New York Public Radio, WNYC, and WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. And the feeling I get, having read the cover story in Time magazine, is that most people in Washington seem to assume that this is going to happen, that it's more likely than unlikely. Why would that be?
Well, there's a couple things at play here. First of all, no politician is willing to stand up and challenge the Bush administration's assertions regarding Iran, because it's the same trap that we fell into regarding Iraq. If you dare question the Bush's case towards Iraq, you weren't accused of being, you know, pragmatic. You were accused of being pro-Saddam. And, you know, now
pro-terrorist.
Pro-terrorist. Now, after 9/11, with the global war on terror, with Iran being highlighted by the Bush administration as the number one state sponsor of terror in the world today, if you dare say, hey, maybe they don't have a nuclear. Wait a minute. Are you sympathetic to those theocrats, those awful mullahs? You're pro-terror, and no politician's willing to do it. And without the oversight of Congress, because that's what we're talking about here, Congress asking the tough questions. Without the oversight, it's a foregone conclusion. We're going to war.
But isn't Iran actually supporting terrorism? They were a major weapons supplier, or the major weapons supplier of Hezbollah, weren't they?
Well, again, now we got to be careful about using the term terror and terrorism. I'm an American. All right. If you attack me, you're a terrorist. All right. If you're Hezbollah, formed on Lebanese soil in 1985 in response to the Israeli invasion and occupation of Lebanon, and your responses are limited to getting Israel out of southern Lebanon, I have trouble viewing that as anti-American terrorism. If I'm an Israeli, I have a different perspective.
Well, but Israel was out of southern Lebanon. They kidnapped an Israeli soldier.
It always cracks me up, you know, that Israel had two soldiers kidnapped. And one of the negotiating thing is, well, we'll trade 700 Lebanese people we have in jail for these two. Wait a minute. No one ever talks about the 700 they got in jail still. Where'd they come from? So it's you can't. What comes first, the chicken or the egg? Again, I'm not here to condone or condemn or whatever. It's just the facts. Two Israeli soldiers were kidnapped on a border that is very volatile, that has Israeli forces going into Lebanon on a continual basis. Let's not confuse this with terrorism. This is a conflict, not terrorism.
With the U.S. military stretched so thin, a ground invasion probably would not be considered.
Oh, well, first of all, I always like hearing people say it's not being considered, because I have been to the School of Advanced Military Studies in Fort Leavenworth, Kansas, recently, twice in the past year. And when you go and look at the maps where all these majors and lieutenant colonels and colonels, the Jedi Knights, the thinkers of the U.S. Army, it's all Azerbaijan and Iran. Oh, they're considering it. It's not the first option. The first option is the bombing campaign.
Well, we don't have enough troops to take care of Iraq right now and Afghanistan.
Well, again, it's how you couch the problem. If we start off with a bombing campaign that's designed to destabilize to the point that the Iranian people rise up to overthrow, let's say they don't rise up and overthrow. Now you can say, well, wait a minute, they just need a little bit more push. So then maybe that push comes in the form of 3 to 4 divisions, which we do have. We can surge 3 to 4 divisions into Azerbaijan, run them down the Caspian Sea coast, which is the plan, to the outskirts of Tehran for that little push. But now that doesn't work. Now we got 40,000 troops stuck in the middle of Iran with no more troops to come. And that's why I said, at that point in time, the Bush administration's nuclear posture policy kicks in place, where we can preemptively use nuclear weapons in a non-nuclear environment if significant numbers of American troops are put in harm's way.
You've said in interviews that the Bush administration has an incoherent policy when it comes to non-proliferation. What is its stated policy on non-proliferation, and what's its stated policy on the preemptive use of nuclear weapons that you've been talking about?
Well, its stated position on non-proliferation is that no other nation in the world can proliferate. You're not allowed to get nuclear weapons. You're not allowed to get anything that we deem you can't have, and it hasn't.
So only the countries that already have them can have them.
But even some of the ones that have them, we want to seek to reverse that trend. But the problem is there's loopholes, there's exceptions. Look at India. Refused to sign the Non-Proliferation Treaty, developed a nuclear weapon, tested a nuclear weapon, had sanctions on it, but now we're saying that's all okay. Here, we'll sell you more nuclear technology. Look at Pakistan. We're supporting Pakistan. Look at Israel. We refused to even address the Israeli issue. Now we have North Korea, which signed the NPT, withdrew from it lawfully, carried out a nuclear test.
It was very successful anyway.
But we should probably remind your listeners, North Korea did not violate any law. Everything North Korea did was in full accordance with the rule of law. They didn't cheat. They did what we do. They did what any other nation does. They said, we want a nuclear weapon. We're going to build one.
A number of listeners have called in and said that they believe the case that you're making and feel that more politicians should be making cases like this. Would you ever consider running for office?
No, I'm not a politician. Politics is a passion. My passions lie elsewhere. And I honestly believe I can be more effective as an American citizen putting pressure from the outside in.
So do you think that there's a possibility that we will be able to pressure Washington to not have this conflict? Or is it just going to be a matter of U.S. regime change?
Well, we have to remember that when we talk about Washington, we're talking about a system of governance. And the key aspect, I think if the American system of governance functions, sometimes sanity prevails. Right now, and I say this as a conservative Republican, we have a Republican-controlled House, a Republican-controlled Senate, a Republican-controlled executive branch. There's no friction. We have nothing but lubrication. So the Bush administration can get any policy objective through Congress without anybody raising their hand asking questions. There's no oversight. This is bad. So after
November, are conservatives like you?
Hopefully doing what I'm doing, but I don't know. Look, everybody's been browbeaten to death after 9/11. We allowed the terrorists to win. I mean, we say, oh, no, we're striking back. No, we're not. We've caved in on the home front. They have had a victory beyond the likes of which they could possibly imagine, where we are declaring war against ourselves, by allowing the fear to intimidate us so that we don't function as a free and democratic society.
When you say that Congress has already given the Bush administration a green light to bomb Iran, what do you mean? There are no bills that have been passed that have said that.
After 9/11, Congress gave the President of the United States the wherewithal to do whatever necessary to win the war on terror. And the President is couching Iran as an extension on the war on terror.
You were on Bill O'Reilly's show recently. What kind of response did you get from that audience?
Well, I don't know about the audience. Mr. O'Reilly, you know, I'm not a big fan of Fox News. I think I've gone on record on that. But I will say this about Bill O'Reilly. You know, right before the war against Iraq, I was on his show, and I was arguing against the existence of these weapons, at least against the Bush administration case. And he said, you know, if we go in and our troops get gassed, will you come on the show and apologize to my listeners for your stance? I said, absolutely. I said, but if we go in and there are no weapons, will you have me on your show so you can apologize to your listeners for this? And he agreed. Well, Fox wouldn't let him bring me back on at that time, but he went on ABC Good Morning America, and he basically said that I was right, that he had been wrong. And so while I don't agree with what he says and how he operates and all that, I have to say that of the entire Fox News team, he's the one guy that I'd be willing to go on, and I did go on.
I wonder if he's going to apologize for identifying Mark Foley as a Democrat from Florida, as they did on his show. That's another matter. Scott Ritter's book, Target Iran, The Truth About the White House's Plans for Regime Change, is published by Nation Books. Thank you so much for being with us again.
Thank you, sir.
Thanks for listening to the Leonard Lopate Show from WNYC, New York Public Radio. You can hear everything we do and check out our other programs on demand at WNYC.org or on iTunes. This on-demand service is made possible by WNYC and its listeners, so please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org. And thanks.